describe the usage of the continuous probe in other programs. I was saying, I believe that, as far as I know, we were the first ones to use it, or one of the first ones to use it as a continuous device in our, in at least the size of the tanks that we're talking about. In most cases, the tank geometry changes, and in some places where they had discrete sensors at certain locations of the tanks, as you get up to the top of the tank, the geometry of the tank changes. And you come up to a dome, in most cases a domed area instead of a nice cylinder. And what happens there, because you have a real change in geometry up there, in some cases, some programs, and I believe the S1C does it, but I'm not particularly, sure of it. They have a small 6-foot section of a continuous probe up on top to take care of the tank geometry conditions.
Yeah, I think I
But
remember seeing that in the
I'm
instructions and
not
stuff. Yeah,
positive of
yeah.
that, but I think that's about the biggest application other than the ones we've had.
Okay, now, did you have, how did you test this thing out? Did you have a big cryogenic tank and you
Yes.
just, did you run into a lot of problems getting the right guidelines here? How did you do that?
Yeah, as far as we had the vendor qualify it for us, since it was quite large, it was, like I said, 20-foot continuous piece, we had some qualify, went through a full development program and full qualification program at the vendor. We did have some debugging to do in the development phase of it, but it went through, even though it was a large program and it was a large material, they had to have special fixtures for vibration-wise, just to take care of the length of it. But the program didn't go through a lot of undue hardships as far as qualification was concerned. It was, I believe, pretty smooth. We had, a lot of development kind of concerns and trying to get the right kind of capacitance changes and the right kind of vibration aspects of it. But in total, I think it was a pretty smooth program. One of the problems that we had was to get real good correlation cryogenic-wise, we ended up, we used to static fire our engines at Sacramento, and this is where we got our full calibre, full cryogenic calibration. What we've done is, in time, develop the confidence and accuracy to know that the vendor is using what they call Freon, and the temperature is somewhat different, but it gives us the same confidence. And we used to correlate the Freon temperatures with the LOX and hydrogen temperatures. And what we've done is ended up having full confidence that what we're doing at the vendor is fine. And in fact, what we've proven now is that we've got full confidence in the system. We've used it on all the S4s, the Saturn IVs and the Saturn IVBs. And we know now that we've got full confidence in the calibration that we get from Minneapolis Honeywell. And it's very, very close. We don't even need the static firings at Sacramento to tell us what the calibrations are. And so from that aspect, I think we've been very happy with the qualification.
Okay, now, gee, I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question, maybe stupid as hell. You've got the capacitance probe in there, which is in a vertical position. The rocket's in a vertical position. You take off. When you're in Earth orbit, getting ready for that last fire for TLI, you're in a horizontal position. How are you checking your capacity in that mode?
Oh yeah, and the capacity in the mode, we don't, the only time the propellant utilization system is used is while the engine is running. Okay, while you're in zero G, you don't know really where the mass is.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so, but you don't need the probe at that particular time, see?
Yeah,
Okay,
okay.
you know, when you lift off, you ask a real good question because it's not as obvious as everybody seems to think. They're not exactly vertical. They're shaped to the geometry of the tank to make the electronics think it's vertical. Now, as soon as we boost off, we've got acceleration and gravity, so all the mass is down to the bottom of the tank, going towards the engine. So you've got forces, gravity forces, pushing you in the direction to make the mass stay at the bottom of the tank. So you've got continuous reading, and it's proper because the mass is at the bottom of the tank. It's like you're forcing this up, so the mass is staying down. Now, as soon as the engine stops, the role of the propellant utilization system is done. Okay, we don't need it anymore. is we know when the engine stopped, we can tell you where the how much mass you had in that tank.
Okay.
Now, we also know the boil-off characteristics of our tank. We know how much insulation we've got. We can tell you if we stay up an hour, if we had so much mass, we'll have so much mass left after an hour because we've boiled off some.
Yeah.
But we'll be able to tell you. Now, we have what they call an APS system on board, which is our attitude auxiliary propulsion system, which are small pods on the side of the engine, which we use to give us a little forward acceleration and settle the tanks.
The ullage.
Yeah, the ullage. Yeah. So that's, as soon prior to starting the engine, we do that, yeah. Settles the tank again, and we're back in business.
Yeah.
So we're ready for restart, and we can go ahead and tell you again how much we've got left and where we are when we stop the engine. We can tell you very, very accurately how many pounds left we have of hydrogen and how many we have left of LOX.
And then during the TLA phase, you've got the this mass settling down again in the bottom of the tank, and you can start reading your, or that starts keeping
during
that
the
ratio
TLI, yes, out. During the TLI burn, we can go, which is our restart burn for sending them to the moon.
Yeah.
We're back in business. It's just like a good gauge. It's like turning the ignition on your tank. You see your gas gauge go up. As soon as you shut it, it goes down.
Right.
And while you're not in the car, or it's in zero G, we can't tell you because the phenomena of zero G says that the mass might be trying to go away from the center of the probe towards the outside of the tank, where it's displaced in such a manner that you can't get a continuous reading at all.
Yeah.
And that's a new, I think, subject that'll probably be considered sometime. Can you develop some methodology, some technology to tell you mass under zero G?
Mm-hmm.
But that'll have to be some sort of a device, a radiation device, a nucleonics kind of device that can penetrate and measure bubbles no matter where they are, gas or liquid or some density there. That it won't be a continuous probe. It'll have to be some sort of nucleonics, I believe, that can give you that feeling.
So you're reading all the time, it's going up, and when that thing shuts off, then you go into Earth orbit, you know exactly how much was in there at the time. And then even though you're still in zero G, you can calculate very accurately the percentage of boil off.
Yes.
Now this is kind of a new area for me. I hadn't thought about
It's not, you know, it's a very good question because a lot of people, but we make no attempt to measure it. And what readings you would get, we get data back, but it's got no bearing.
You've only got one more burn after that now. You impact on the moon.
Yes, but we don't burn with the main engine for that one.
That's right, it's the APS.
Yes.
I bet, yeah, that's right.
After our TLI burn, we go through what we call the evasive maneuver.
Yeah.
And where we there want to make sure that we're away from the astronauts and far enough separated from them. And the way we do that is by turning on our APS system. We actually burn somewhat to separate them, or they separate a little bit from us on the evasive maneuver. And when we're separated enough from them, we're going on our particular way. At that time, we're shooting for the moon. A few hours after that, we get, if we haven't achieved enough of a velocity from that first burn, our first what they call APS burn, we will get a command from the ground to burn again, puts us in the right attitude. So we burn a second time before impacting the moon, but that's not done with our main engine, it's done with our APS engines. And at that time we're not reading, the propellant utilization system was through as far as the mission was concerned right after TLI burn. So when we impact the moon, we've generated that particular attitude by the auxiliary propulsion system, not the main propellant system. And we don't have any mass a continuous mass readout of the APS.
Okay, now you said you were involved in the electronics, but did you have to get involved too, and what kind of valves were going in there to make sure you were getting your...
Oh, yes.
Was it use a solenoid switch, or how do you accomplish that?
Yeah, the valve itself was a valve that at that time was a solenoid control valve with a motor in it. Now, that was provided to us by Rocketdyne. The Rocketdyne company had the development of the valve on S4B. And what we did there when we were doing the design of the S4B, there was very, very close liaison because all the characteristics of the PU system and the inverter converter would have to be phased to supply the phases of the motor. It was a two-phase motor on that valve. One was what we call a fixed phase, which was 115 volts, 400 cycles, and that gives you a reference. The other phase was controlled by the propellant utilization system, and that varied because what we wanted to do with that, and that was known as a control phase. What you want to do is, as a function of what was happening in the hydrogen tank, you wanted to compare what was happening in the LOX tank, generate an error signal, drive that through the electronics system, the propellant utilization system, and then drive the control phase of this motor, which was on the Rocketdyne valve for the S4B. Mm-hmm. And then the 115 volts gives you a reference to stabilize around, and then the PU would then tell this motor, turn this way. You get an error signal, it would be amplified, and to the motor it would look like some known voltage. Some error would say, some plus error would say, okay, turn 20 volts this way, and it go this way. Mm-hmm. Some other error, some negative error, would make it seem like a negative 20 volts in the other direction, and it would turn the valve the other direction. So you could go on either side of what we would call our engine mixture ratio of 5-0-1. Mm-hmm. The valve had about a 30 degree spread from its null position. It would start at 5-0-1, could go to a mixture ratio of 5-5, which about was equivalent to about 15 mechanical degrees. Or it could go from 5-0 to 4-5, which was another equivalent of about 15 degrees. So the valve would rotate about 30 degrees.
Is that a ball valve in there? Are you a butterfly? Or what kind of a gizmo was that?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think it was the Rocketdyne valve itself. It's kind of a bypass valve. And I guess they're all butterfly to some extent. Mm-hmm. But the way we would do it, we would bypass that particular valve, mm-hmm. or flow some of the locks around that valve to change the characteristics.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with all the, you know, the finite details of the valve. But we were in very close coordination with Rocketdyne because we had to meet all the characteristics, the input impedance characteristics of the motor. We would have to know what the characteristics were involved with all the electronics, the solenoid control, or the actual motor itself. So what we ended up doing is, in close coordination with Rocketdyne, we talked to those guys, our design people would talk to theirs, and we actually ended up getting a development valve from them. Okay, and we utilized it during our design phase of the, or our development test phase, to see that the marriage between our electronics and their valve was compatible. And then that's how we ended up doing it.
Do you remember any details at all about the S2 propellant utilization? Did they have nearly as much of a factor involved?
Yes, what we did is, on the S2 PU system, basically we used the same design concepts that we had developed on the S4 and the S4B program.
We had come over and just ask you about them, and you gave the information. How did that?
Yeah, no. What we ended up doing was we developed the S2PU system for them.
Oh, I misunderstood. Yeah.
Yes. So we designed the S4 and the S4B and the S2PU system, mm-hmm. and so we acted as a vendor to North American. They defined to us the requirements. We had been working very, very closely with the S2 people. We had designed the S4 and the S4B. Mm-hmm. And the S2 was a natural follow-on to the S4B. We used the same concepts. We used the same parts where applicable. We ended up having to make a larger inverter and a larger box because they had five valves, five engines, right, where we had one engine. But all the concepts, all the electronics were basically the same, and all the material that went in, all the designs that went into the S4B were just upgraded to take care of the five engines, mm-hmm. and the five, mm-hmm. valves. Mm-hmm. The probes were essentially the same as we had used on 4 and 4B, and we bought them from the same vendor, same kind of qualification, same kind of development. We had had all the development history, so it was just kind of a natural outgrowth, and we provided the probes and electronics to North American on that basis.
Yeah. And is Minneapolis Honeywell again?
Yes, Minneapolis Honeywell has been our probe vendor since the S4 days. Yeah. So So they provide the pros for us and for both S4, S4B, and S2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we were very close with North American. North American defined all the specs that they wanted us to meet. And we compared them with the S4B and got with them and said, but we had to go through a new qualification program with the box because it was bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different size because of the five valves.
Yeah.
But we went through a full-blown qualification program for them. And they've been using it ever since.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting about the Apollo program are the spin-off factors. Are there any other places you can use a capacitance utilization probe besides an S4B bird?
Well, I think so. In time, I think it'll be a great usage. I think one of the problems that you have now is that probably the concept is being used. And I feel that any place like in medicine where you're trying to measure accuracies very, very carefully, spheres, where they be used. Right now, not only the S4B, I believe the spacecraft is using continuous capacitance probes too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not positive where they are, but I believe in some of the tankage in the Apollo command module, service module, are using continuous probes now, but in smaller tanks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think any place in the future where it's very, you need to know on a continuous basis where you are in particular spheres. And I see particular applications sometimes in medicine where you're interested in looking at some things very, very accurately. You know, bear trucks someday.
Yeah.
You name it.
I don't know
directly where you would take one now and say, hey, if you stuck it in there, it would look good.
Yeah.
But I think the concept is very useful because any place that you have to know on a continuous basis what particular mass you're interested in, I think you'll have a future application. And I'm sure that Mini Honey is exploring that one considerably now.
Yeah. I'm still a little bit vague on what this thing is constructed of. How is it fabricated? What kind of
probe is it's a continuous element, and I've got some pictures of it I'll be glad to show you. It's made up of two elements. One's a stainless steel element and one's an aluminum element.
Uh-huh.
And it's an extruded, long extruded element. Basically like about a 4-inch pipe that's about 20 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what it basically looks like. It's kind of hard to see. But it's basically made up of a 20-foot span, and it's got an inner and outer electrode.
Mm-hmm.
The outer element is 2014 T6 aluminum, and the inner element is stainless steel, 321 CRES.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 20 feet long, and it fits into the tank. In our LOX tank, we actually come in through the bottom of the LOX tank. There's what we call a feed-through. This is where the engine mounts.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a small feed-through and a flange, and the probe itself fits into a funnel arrangement. We have a baffling arrangement and a small funnel arrangement at the top of the tank, and this probe actually slips into that funnel, and it's held there. We have some Teflon inserts here that fit up and are held at the top of the tank. And the feed-through mates right at the bottom of the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And from an installation standpoint, you can actually remove the LOX probe without going into the LOX tank. You can replace the probe by just dropping the feed-through mm-hmm. arrangement here and dropping it out. In the hydrogen tank, it's a little bit different. In the hydrogen tank, the probe, we have a manhole cover up at the top of the hydrogen tank. We put in the hydrogen probe, and it's held by A-frame rings. And then the wiring itself, it's not an integral part of the feed-through. The probe is not an integral part of the feed-through at the top of the tank. You actually have to put the probe in through the manhole and then attach it to the frames. And then you bring the electrical wiring associated with the top of the probe out to a feed through on top of the tank, on the dome. Therefore, you can work on it electrically, but you couldn't work on it physically. You'd have to get inside the tank to get to the actual probe. And the hydrogen probe, both the hydrogen probe and the LOX probe are made of the same material. They have an outer element made of aluminum and an inner element made of stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a coupling, which is actually, it mates together with a ring, and we just held it, you know, it's held together about halfway up the probe. On the hydrogen side, it's about 20 feet from here to the coupling and about 20 feet up above. So the whole span is approximately 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Would be very difficult to work at, you know, unless you're able to get into the tank, whereas on the LOX side, you're able to drop the LOX probe itself. You ever have a problem with the hydrogen side probe, you'd have to work on it inside the tank.
Mm-hmm. Was this kind of a propellant utilization system really a Douglas thing, or were there interfaces with, did Marshall come and say, why don't you try this, or did you get into any problems like that?
Oh yeah, in the initial phases, I believe that there were, everyone was interested. I think both Marshall and Douglas were interested in coming up with what is the best system to monitor the mass of the tank. We had certain requirements. Both Marshall and ourselves
mm-hmm.
had certain requirements at that time that we wanted to be able to load very accurately, to be able to get data in flight and on the ground, and to be able to minimize residuals. And by residuals, we wanted to make sure that both the hydrogen and the LOX depleted at the same rate and were minimal after you got through with the initial mission.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you could optimize for payload. So everybody was interested in that concept. That was everybody. That was McDonald, North American, S1C, and Marshall. And Marshall had asked us to look at the concept. That's what we wanted to do. Okay, what we did, based on those kind of requirements, that we wanted to optimize for payload, minimize residuals, be very accurate as far as loading was concerned. We went and surveyed the industry of what was available to do that. And our people at the initial phases of the propellant utilization scheme came up and looked at all schemes, discrete level sensors, acoustical sensors, hot wire sensors, continuous capacitance probes, and they were all evaluated. There was a big parametric study made for about 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
What's available? Once you've defined the requirements, you'd like to do these things, what's available in the industry that you don't have to talk about developing and looking at? What can meet those? And we went and looked and surveyed, and at that particular time, it looked like the continuous probe delta capacitance change concept would provide the most assurance to meet all those requirements. The discrete levels could give you certain requirements, but they couldn't fulfill all the requirements as accurately. So, okay, we came up at that time with this big parametric study. We all sat down together with Marshall and we said, we think this is the best way to go to meet all those requirements. And I think Marshall agreed with us at that time. Yes, we showed them all our concepts or all the trade-off studies that were made against all the other systems. There wasn't anyone left off. They scurred, looked at the total industry, like I said, hot wire sensors, acoustical sensors, capacitance sensors at that time.
How long did this kind of search last? Been a month, 6 months, a year?
Oh, no, I think there was about, it was a few months were involved.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say probably 3-4 months.
Then you went to Minneapolis Honeywell, and you said, this is what we want?
What we did is, no, what we did at that particular time is we said, okay, here's the concept. We defined the concept. We wrote what we call specification requirements drawings.
Mm-hmm.
Once we had evolved into the system that said, yes, we're interested in developing a capacitance type electronic closed loop propellant system, then we knew we wanted a capacitance type of device, a continuous capacitance type device. So what we did is we wrote requirements that said, okay, this probe has to give us these things. It has to give us an electrical signal with a change of capacitance so we can know the mass. has to meet these vibration levels because it's going to see this in flight. It's going to have to see these cryogenic temperatures because it's going to have to see all these things. And we wrote all those things in the form of a requirement, what we call specification drawings. And then we went through what we go through in our normal procurement cycle. We put it out for a bid.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went out to all the people that are interested in those kind of devices. And we got back a lot of responses, or I don't believe I remember exactly the number of responses, but it went through a normal procurement cycle, and Minneapolis Honeywell was chosen as the one to develop the concept for the probe, and they did. So that's how it was done. And in that same requirement, in that specification requirement, we defined what development cycles it had to go through, what qualification cycles it had to go through, to prove that it was what we wanted, or that it met all the requirements we had asked for.
Yeah.
And that's what it was qualified to. So that's how Minneapolis Honeywell got the particular job on the probes.
Are those probes now stored in the S4B stages that we saw with North American?
Yes, they're inside the tank.
There's no deterioration problem as far as these things are concerned?
No, there's no, we haven't, we don't feel there is any, and we've looked in both the we've had some stages that we've had in long-term storage at Sacramento now,
mm-hmm.
which was our 206 and 208 stage, and we've looked at, we've gone inside the tank on both of them, just for the probe and other things inside the tank, and we haven't seen any deterioration whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And we do intend to look at, we're going to look inside the tank for 210 and 209,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be getting some history on those. But up on... So far, we haven't seen any detrimental effect whatsoever with long-term storage.
Did Minneapolis Honeywell think that this is a particular, or any of your vendors, think this is really a hard thing to do given the, you know, the cryogenic thing and the vibration level and the fact that it's continuous? Is this a real advance to the state of the art?
Well, I think at the time that we started development, I think it was.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't know of anyone else that had developed one that was 20 feet or 40 feet long.
Yeah.
So at that time, I think it was at least an advance in the state of the art at that particular time. Maybe today not, but in 1960, 61, I think it was probably, the answer was probably yes to that.
You got no guy at Marshall named Schuller?
Mm-hmm.
He was involved with transducers and stuff like that. I remember that he was talking about gauges of one kind or another.
Oh, well, I'm sure that deucers in general have been a very fantastic thing, especially where if you talk about electronics.
Yeah.
Okay, see, in this particular case, it's all mechanical. There's no electronics involved here. It's outside where it's not seeing cryogenics. Our electronic portion is in a nice ambient panel,
mm-hmm.
or a cold plate where
yeah.
it's warm. I'm sure that you would, any deucer that you developed that had some electronics associated with cryogenics, you would have had some development concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, the state of the art in cryogenics, as far as electronics was concerned, was not as far as it is today.
Yeah.
Today, you can probably pick resistors, transistors that work around cryogenic temperatures if you hand pick them. At that time, we were probably in some concern.
Mm-hmm. How did you get along with Marshall people? Did you get along pretty well? No problem with any of them?
Me personally, no.
Yeah?
No, I don't. Well, I'd tell you if I did. I think one of the things that we've learned is that, and I work with the guys on S4 and 4B, and I think they're a pretty reasonable bunch of guys.
Okay, I just about stayed my time. We just about run the tape out here. Do you have anything you'd care to add before I shut down?
No.
Okay.
That'd be fine.
Yeah. Just start talking. I think we're go.
All right. Well, I-